We'll now call the third case on this morning's oral argument document, Shelley Durrell Haynes Kritz and Roger Allen Kritz versus Roger Allen Kritz et al. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, good morning. my name is Jeremy Martin. I represent the cross appellant, Roger Kritz, in this case. And I want to talk about two points very briefly with the court this morning. One being Roger's issue on his cross appeal, and the other being Roger's agreement with his parents, Joe and Sherry, that the trial court's judgment is supported by the record. With regard to Roger's issue on appeal, what happened below is the trial court designated him a managing conservator of his son, Ryder, and then entered an order saying that his periods of possession were whenever Joe and Sherry wanted them to be. The trial court did not designate specific periods of possession and access, but instead left it up to the discretion of the grandparents. It's very well settled law in Texas when you've designated someone a managing conservator and you want to limit their time with the child, their access and possession of the child, you have to designate specific periods of possession and access. It's undisputed that didn't happen here. And if you look at the parties' briefs, all of the parties have expressed agreement with this. This was an abuse of discretion, and that this ought to be reversed and remanded to the trial court in order to give Roger specified periods of possession and access to Ryder.
And I assume this was presented to the trial court, the concern here, and
well, it's a very good question. In terms of when and how or whether it was put to the trial court, at the time there was a concern that maybe Roger and his parents and all the parties wouldn't necessarily agree to this relief just because of the situation that was ongoing. I think it would have been presented in a post-judgment motion, a motion to modify or something of that nature, had Shelley not appealed it. But once it was appealed, this was a situation where Roger sort of, I think, decided that it would be a better idea to go ahead and bring it on up here with the conventional appeal, the principal appeal, out of concern that possibly the trial court might not be so willing to reform any judgment or anything like that while it was on appeal, so that we kind of all get it done in one fell swoop. With regard to the second point I want to talk about, it's the record clearly supports the trial court's appointment of Joe and Sherry as the primary conservators. You just have to look at it. It's a very conventional legal and factual sufficiency analysis, and there is clearly evidence in the record to support what the trial court did, and it's also Roger's position, along with, and at this point I want to make clear that Roger did file a motion to join in the brief of Joe and Sherry, and this court granted that motion, so Roger has officially and formally on the record joined with their position, that the whole the parental presumption in this case didn't apply because Shelley was appointed a managing conservator. So it either didn't apply, or if it did apply, it was satisfied. The burden was met. And unless the court has any further questions, I'm happy to give back any time I have left. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Flint.
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent Shelley Kritz, the mother in this case, and it's, I guess, not absolutely necessary that I point out that I disagree with the last statement that he made. It may be very clear on the record that Roger Kritz was not able to be appointed as a managing conservator with the primary designation, but I do not believe it's clear on the record that the same applied to Shelley. Additionally, I believe that the parental presumption did apply in this case based on the court's holding in De La Pena out of the Court of Appeals in El Paso. The courts are clear and the statutes are clear that a parent should be appointed over a non-parent if a sole managing conservatorship or something like that comes up. The ambiguity arises in this case because under the joint managing conservatorship statute, the statute reads a little bit funny about whether or not it applies when all of the parties are named joint managing conservators. So we believe that it does apply. In De La Pena, they said that appointing a parent as joint managing conservator, and if that circumvented the right of the parent to the parental presumption, that they could then go ahead and argue the designation of primary, let me start over. I think I misstated what I was trying
to say. Let me ask you, the trial court recognized that the parental presumption applied, did he not? I mean, he made a finding that the parental presumption had been rebutted.
Correct. He did. And the problem with that was that even though he said the parental presumption had been rebutted, he didn't state how, and his findings of fact didn't clearly state how he came to that decision. In Chavez, also out of the El Paso courts, they stated that the judge had to enter a finding once the mother requested findings of fact that the appointment of the parent would not be in the best interest of the child because that was a significant impairment to the child. And in this case, he entered findings of fact that state that it would be in the best interest of the parent, of the child, for the grandparents to be appointed, but it's kind of by default because in family law there's a lot of the forms that are already written. So it was kind of like it was in there because that's just what everything revolves around on these issues of conservatorship, the best interest of the child.
So he makes a finding that the presumption has been rebutted, but he doesn't make a specific finding of fact on endangerment.
No.
But in that situation, don't we just look to the record to see if there's evidence that would support the judge's finding on those endangerment issues? And if so, we would affirm?
Well, the Court of Appeals in Chavez believed that when you applied the rules concerning findings, that the fact that they did not find either element of that ground prevented anything from being presumed to the Court of Appeal. So they foreclosed the notion right off the bat, as did the court in Landry out of Tyler, that the ground of significant impairment was not to be presumed at the Court of Appeals because no element of that was found.
Well, actually what the judge did in this case, it seems to me that he made a finding which I guess you could arguably say was conclusory. It just covered the whole, mm-hmm. all bases. He didn't narrow it down into specific elements, and I think you're talking about a case where the judge might make a finding as to one element but not the others. I don't know, but it seems to me that his finding was enough to cover all of the elements of what would rebut a presumption, and the question we have is just whether there's evidence to support that.
I do not believe that there is. In this case, in prior cases, they have stated that the parental presumption is rebutted if there is significant endangerment to the child. And you can look to the facts of the case, and you need to look at what's happened recently, and I stated that in my brief. And you can also see the recent past. I guess this case would turn on whether or not he was justified or arbitrary in applying his definition of what recent past was, because there were some things, evidence that showed that Shelley had not made good decisions in the past. But as of the trial in March of 2007, I think most of that had been cleared up by 2005. So you're looking at a 2-year gap where there really wasn't anything that said that Shelley would be a significant harm to him. Now, they did point out that they had a murky pool, some glass under a trampoline, and an open flame inside the house. But I don't know if that's enough on its own to reach a significant impairment. In fact, both social workers in the case stated that they did not think that that would. Also, the courts have also stated that the you can't just have a mere surmise or suspicion that something could happen. It can't be a potential. They need to show some instance of harm. There was no showing on the record that Shelley has harmed this child. They did not have an expert to come in and testify that the child had been harmed, that he was in great distress after he saw her, that he was afraid of her, or that something had happened. In 2005, when the court knew that she had tested positive for Xanax, a prescription medication, as opposed to Xanax that she was using illegally, the court immediately after that granted her an entire month of possession that she was unsupervised. And I think if the court had felt that it was a danger in 2005, they would have not given her that unsupervised contact at that time. Since that time, the court has looked at several cases, and it appears that most of them, with the exception of May, state that there really has to be a significant burden. In May, there was proof that the dad had not used drugs in 2 years, but it was only based on him and no rehabilitation. He was using and selling illegal drugs with the child in the house, and the court found that that was sufficient evidence. In this case, you do not have the same fact circumstance. You have Shelley with a disease or illness that required a lot of interchanging medications. In addition, there was some concern about her taking a drug called Actique that is a morphine, a drug for pain. There was no evidence presented that she wasn't prescribed that medication by a drug or that she wasn't using it within what the doctor had given her. In addition to that, in July, and that was between May and July of 2005, in August of 2005, she became concerned about the amount of the drug that she was having to take in order for it to relieve the migraines and body pain that she was having as a result of her MS, which everyone agrees she does have on the record, even though in some places they say alleged. When she was using this, she became concerned. She's told her doctor, "This is scaring me. I don't want to take this drug anymore." He prescribes Suboxone, which the pharmacist testified is good, intended to be used for people to wean them off of morphine. She took that, and her drug records show that after that she did not use the morphine pops that they were concerned about. And you'll see that referred to over and again as fentanyl or Actique in the record. So given that you're limited in the recent past, in my judgment of what the recent past is, I think you just got the murky pool, the trampoline, and the flame, and I don't believe that that raises it to the level of significant harm. Also, with the issue of voluntary relinquishment, the grandparents were required to show that she had voluntarily relinquished the child for 1 year or more. And at trial, everybody agreed that Shelley moved into the home with Ryder 2 weeks after he moved there in 2003, and that she continued to live there until June of 2004. The Kreitzes on appeal have come back and said that they think that they established their 1 year because she was out of the house most weekends leading up to June of 2004. There was a recent opinion that was released regarding standing in which this court stated that you can have parents living in the home who, and then the grandparents would naturally have, or the non-parent would naturally have a day-to-day duties that they would do, but unless the parent turns everything over to them, that would not be sufficient to show that they had control of the child at that time. And in this case, there's no evidence in the record that Shelley did that until June. And between June and January of 2005, when this case was filed, she also was extremely ill and unable to travel, and I believe that the record shows that as well, if that answers your question. And that, unless there are any other questions, I think I'll give you back some time.
Thank you, Ms. Plant. Ms. Simpson?
May it please the court, my name is Georgiana Simpson, and I represent Joe and Sherry Kreitz, the grandparents who are awarded primary joint managing conservatorship in this case. Okay. First of all, the court asked about well, a number of things, whether we should the parental presumption, whether the court – yes, the court made a finding of fact slash conclusion of law that they rebutted the parental presumption. That's out of abundance of caution because I do not think that under 153-131 that was necessary in this case because both the parents and the grandparents were appointed joint managing. And I think Gardner was properly analyzed the case because it's legislative, it's constructive, construction of the statute. The statute doesn't mention primary, but that's somewhat irrelevant because there is sufficient evidence on both grounds. I think the court will note in the prayer they have asked for a rendition, not for a remand. So this is really a legal sufficiency rather than a factual sufficiency issue here. And there certainly is some evidence to support. I think there's more than some evidence. I think there was overwhelming evidence to support. And, you know, I think past conduct certainly does show what's going to happen in the future. This lady only spent the year before this was filed, she only spent 20% of the time with this child, 73 nights in that house, or 73 nights, not necessarily in that house, with the child. She decided to pursue other romantic relationships. She has a history of doing this. And leaving her children with grandparents, this is what happened here. So we have voluntary relinquishment, and we have significant impairment. The evidence is certainly replete, but I think there's enough showing that it was some support in the record for the judge doing what the judge did.
And what evidence of significant impairment in?
Well, I think significant impairment. I says they want to limit this to what happened after, you know, during the trial, but the judge, I think, could reasonably go back to the year before this was filed and what brought these grandparents around to finding that they had to file it. Plus, she's completely overlooked the fact this child had a diagnosis of ADHD, this child needs stability, and this child doesn't need to be fixing their own breakfast in the morning and eating fast food and not having a parent that is consistently involved. They cite to one case, the NRA MW case, which I think is very instructive for our purposes. There, the mother was off to get an education. She was gone for 2 years, but she saw the child regularly, spoke to the child regularly, took the child for holidays, took the child for vacations. The court still found that she had relinquished the child for that 2 years to the grandparents. Here we have a mother that was much less involved. Even after she was giving periods of possession to the child, she sometimes didn't exercise all those periods of possession, would take the child to the bar. With her recent drug history, you know, whatever, and especially with her fiancé's drug history, these folks working at a bar calls into concern. Certainly taking the child there calls that into concern and calls into question their parenting ability. You know, I think that shows a significant impairment.
Was there evidence in the record that the child's father was still living with the Kreitzes?
Yes, ma'am. There's evidence there that Roger was still – actually, after Shelley moved out, Roger moved in shortly thereafter.
And what about his drug problem?
Okay. He characterizes himself as a, quote-unquote, practicing alcoholic. I'm not sure what that is. I think you can put two or three different takes on it, whether it's somebody who can have a beer now and then, or he's saying, well, no, I'm an alcoholic. I'm always going to be an alcoholic. I don't know what that means. But he has been to rehab sometimes, but he's never there unless the Kreitzes are there. So, I mean, there was not a lot of evidence developed. He does have a past, you know, drug history. He's also had a history of rehab. He also put in evidence that he was maintaining a job, had a consistent job. Here, she didn't have a job. Well, she has a job, but it's all at the discretion of her boyfriend's parents. She doesn't have to get a paycheck. She gets to live in their house in exchange for some work that she does at the club, which varied from, oh, I don't do very much when I was all sick, to toting light boards, to going to Austin to get liquor licenses, buying Christmas gifts, but not being able to see her son. So, you know, there is some testimony that she works every weekend, and she works 10 a.m. to like 4 a.m. or something. Sometimes parties on Thursday night. She had her son there on a Wednesday night. So, it's, you know, it seems to be all over the place about when she works and what she does, but she certainly is not directly compensated. Plus, she doesn't have an automobile. She had no health insurance. She had Medicaid for the son. So, you know, if her relationship breaks down, which there's a history of her relationships breaking down, then she's out the door. theoretically, because, I mean, she's totally dependent on this man, you know, so, and she's not married to him now because she couldn't get married to him until after the divorce. I do not know what the current status is. But she certainly, if she does get her life straightened out, if she does get married, things happen, we have modifications. She has a remedy here. You know, she can improve her life, and I doubt seriously the judge is not, I mean, that's the point of modifications, is to go back
in. That's a year out from the date of the decree, a year out.
Yes.
She can file for motion to modify a year from, yeah.
All right. So, I mean, there's sufficient. In fact, you know, we talked about, we're really not opposed to Roger having some time with this child and having it carved out separately. I think our whole point was, again, if and when that happened, when he moved out or this was an issue, again, a motion to modify would have been appropriate. So that's why we're not waiving. I think was probably waived, but we're all in agreement that that was what the court should have done. I think if it had been brought up at the time, I think this court would have that's what this court would have done. Just nobody really thought about it. It never came up. He was living with the parents. The parents hadn't been letting him, you know, he had full access to the child. So that was the situation. So, I mean, I think that, you know, I think this court could, you know, doesn't even have to remand for that, but we're certainly not opposed to remanding for that purpose, just solely, though, for that purpose. But we think the judgment should be affirmed, you know, because I think that there's plenty of evidence there to support what this judge did. So unless the court has questions, I'll also give you back some time.
Thank you, Ms. Simpson. Ms. Flint or Mr. Martin, which of you want to do a rebuttal?
Okay.
Again, Your Honors, the point of the case is whether or not they prove significant harm in this. She was ill. That is in the record. That's in the record by Sherry's testimony, that she was ill, that at the end of 2004, she was so sick that she vomited so many times her esophagus was ruptured and she was throwing up blood. It's very clear that she was very sick the last end of that year. Again, you have to show not just that she made bad decisions, but that he was harmed by it. And in this case, we have a kid who adores his mom, has told lots of different people, I want to live with my mom, told both social workers, tells all of his family, I want to live with mom, told Roger's counselor, I want to spend more time with mom. Additionally, the court gave her, if not 50%, pretty darn close to 50% of the time with this child unsupervised. If the court had concerns that significant harm was going to happen to her, he probably should have given her less time. The other issue is, we hear all these things about how he fixes his own breakfast and he has fast food. Let's not forget, he's with her on the weekends at the time of trial. You don't necessarily sit down on the weekends because you're on the go. The other issue is that she does not have a job and she does not have a paycheck. Again, we don't see an issue of harm here. In Llewellyn, the court said it didn't matter that the mom lived in crowded conditions, and it didn't matter if she didn't have a job. Is that harming the child? And in this case, it is not harming this child, and they offered no proof that it was. The other issue that I wanted to bring to the court's attention is that if you don't apply the parental presumption to this case, you go into it with the court just being, any court being able to say, okay, I'm going to give them all JMC and we'll get around this difficult thing, giving away the close call. The problem with that is that this is a fundamental right. You don't just give away a fundamental right. You have to give them the opportunity to show that. And what happens if you don't is that the judge can go ahead and say, okay, I'm going to give them JMC, but I'm going to make the grandparent primary, and then give the non-parent rights that they may not should have under a joint managing conservatorship, which is basically what he did in this case. He said JMC and rebutted the presumption, and then he gave them rights that only a parent would have under the parental presumption and under sole managing conservatorship of a parent. Certain rights under that, under 153.373, are exclusive to a parent. In this case, he gave those exclusive rights to a non-parent. The non-parent provision on the same thing is not exclusive. So he has taken from them the ability to make medical and dental decisions, psychiatric and psychological decisions that they absolutely have a right to do. He's given the sole discretion to the grandparents, which is also an abuse of discretion in this case. So without a showing of harm and without a showing that they had the child for a year, I think it was an abuse of discretion for him to give away even a regular joint managing conservatorship as primary. The De La Pena case points to that. The Gardner case, you have to remember, the parents agreed that they would give up JMC. She pretty much waived the issue by saying, you can have JMC, but I want to fight over primary. In this case, that was never given up. Shelley has always asked for sole managing conservatorship, and I don't believe they have met their burden to show that. And I don't believe the court has entered the proper order to show that a sound judgment was made in this case. I don't believe this evidence is sufficient to show that without a showing of significant harm that has happened. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flint, Mr. Martin, and Ms. Simpson. We appreciate very much your appearing here this morning to present your arguments. They were all very helpful. The case is submitted, and we'll ask the clerk to adjourn us for the day.